You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, March 25th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Roosevelt Fellow Mike Konzel on how free trade isn't about trade. It's about bureaucrats and guns. And also, why are liberals resigned to low wages? Also on the program today, our probably daily report on the clown car. It's just there's too much as they begin to expose themselves more. Oh, boy. More on the budget fight and the dock fix. Meanwhile, 401ks, more reports failing. And speaking of FUs, we've got a couple of FUs more in Afghanistan for our military forces. Freedmen units, as they're known. Also, the just sick, demented. We're going to play some sound from you. It won't be from Robert Durst. It'll be from the Duck Dynasty guy, but not terribly different in terms of their visions of humanity. A Republican in, where is this guy from? He's got a new saying. It's not teach a person to fish and they eat for a lifetime. It's just that people on food stamps shouldn't be allowed to have fish. That's it. And a ruling in the Young versus UPS case that I think people will find encouraging. And I admit I find it a little bit surprising. Before we get to that, I want to first thank you guys for all of your voting and efforts with the podcast awards. We won't know, I think, probably for a couple of weeks what the outcome is, but I appreciate everybody voting and somewhat apologetic about harping on it. I just can't wait for the day where I'm not going to harp on anything, but I don't know if that'll ever come. But the text messages and whatnot reminding you to vote, I appreciate people voting. I wanted to just read an email we got. I'm going to keep the guy's name anonymous. He's been a very strong supporter of this program.
Oh, this guy is anonymous? Like he is anonymous? Forget it.
No. Just I'm not going to say his name. But he has been a very supportive of this program over the years, and gave a big contribution to our Indiegogo campaign. And so I just want to read this email because it really it's extremely gratifying. I mean, obviously, it's gratifying to get financial support, but getting emails like this is in a way. In some ways, even more gratifying. I've been a listener of the Majority Report since its first week on Air America, and we're actually coming up. We're 6 days away from the 11-year anniversary of that happening. It has been part of the soundtrack for my life for nearly a decade and a half. I don't look at my Indiegogo contribution as a donation, but rather an investment and a payback. It's an investment in a vibrant and independent voice on the left. It's an investment in Majority.fm continuing its fight against the darkness. My payment isn't large. It's actually just pennies. It's large, too, though. That's me editorializing. Pennies for each right-wing Mandela. Pennies for each laugh. Pennies for each closet door creaking on Lindsey Graham. Pennies for each King V. Burwell reference. And pennies for Casual Friday. Well, now you guys know why I talk about King V. Burwell so many times, because we get a couple of pennies for it every time. I listen to a lot of podcasts. Many make me laugh. Many inform me. Many interest me. The Majority Report, I think, is the only one that makes me a better, more rounded person. Now is the time for listeners like me to show what the Majority Report means to us with pennies and dollars and proving what a difference MR has made in our lives. Very gratifying email to get. And we're very appreciative of the financial support. And folks, if you don't have the cash to spare, by all means, just pass it, the link around. Pass the turn people on to the show. At the end of the day, what we're hoping to raise money for is just going to go back into hopefully building a mechanism that will expand the reach of the show. And we'll talk more about that as the days go on. But I just wanted to say how much we appreciated that email. And obviously all the work and the donations that we've been getting on the Indiegogo campaign, we're significantly past the halfway mark at this point. And really appreciate the support. Don't know what else to say beyond that, except we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Konzel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program Roosevelt Fellow, contributor to The Nation magazine, also to other publications, of course, Mike Konzel. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back on, man.
So let's start with your piece on free trade. I mean, I love this piece for a number of reasons. One, of course, because this is going to be, in my mind, really the biggest story on the left of the next, 6 months. When it comes to a policy standpoint, we know that there's going to be budget negotiations. We know that the Republicans may, if they sort out what's going on intracenely, I guess, if that's a word, There may or may not be some attempts to close down the government. But this is the one where there's a real fight. There's a split in the Democratic Party over fast-track authority and its implications for the TPP and its sister or cousin agreement with the EU. And you write that free trade isn't about trade. It's about bureaucrats and guns. How so?
Sure. So it's important to remember when people are going to be talking about free trade this year, and you're right, it's going to be one of the most dominant issues. Unions are already withholding funding, depending on, you know, how this is resolved. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about President Obama and now Hillary Clinton kind of rhetorically moving to the left on inequality and wages and, you know, universal pre-K and all kinds of other things. But this is where the rubber is going to hit the road. President Obama is going to ask for authority to essentially negotiate this, and Congress will have to pass what he comes up with, something called fast-track authorization, which liberals like Elizabeth Warren are very worried about, and they're very worried about specific parts of this bill. Hillary Clinton still hasn't weighed in on the bill, though she was in favor of it while Secretary of State. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, you know, they hear free trade and maybe they like that idea or maybe they don't. But the idea that this is about countries trading with each other is such a minimal and small part of that, of this bill. Those decisions about how we're going to trade with countries were basically done in the 1950s and 60s. What we're talking about now is the way international corporations trade and how we can regulate them and what powers they have in different countries.
And we should say, I mean, every time I hear something about people like the idea of free trade, I think it was Thomas Friedman said, all he needs to hear is free trade, and that's it. He doesn't need to read the details, I guess. And you make the great point, though, that, and I think it's in one of these pieces that you wrote. It's actually in the other piece about why liberals are resigned to low wages, which we'll get to soon. But you quote David Graeber as saying, whenever someone starts talking about the free market, it's a good idea to look around for the man with the gun. And the idea being that someone has to enforce any trade. Now, I've spent a lot of time over the years arguing with libertarians. The last one was a business school professor from Loyola who told me, the way you work this out is everybody's going to have their own court, and then there'll be another court that will mediate the decisions of those courts, and so on and so on. But at the end of that, there's a guy holding a gun, right? And or a bureaucrat.
Right. Like when you hear a narco-capitalist or whatever talking about, what they're really describing is like gang warfare or like mobs competing to like who's going to protect local businesses. Those situations usually sound pretty terrible if you actually had to think through who's going to enforce what. And they're just so they're rhetorical distractions from the actual reality we face, which is, you know, if Philip Morris wants to sell cigarettes in Australia, and this is a real case and I talk about it in the piece, you know, Australia passed a law saying that they had to do, they basically passed an anti-smoking campaign, and you know, they had to package their cigarettes in a way that had a lot of ads saying how unhealthy it is to smoke. And you know, this is like, you know, public health concerns. It's, you know, this is a general welfare. This is the stuff states normally do. Modern states kind of were designed to do. And no one thinks like the, you know, I assume unless you're really in the pocket of someone, no one thinks that smoking is like really healthy. So this is a totally legitimate thing for Australia to do. And under one of these free trade agreements, something called an investor dispute clause, which is really one of the things that a lot of people focused on in TPP. Senator Elizabeth Warren has written op-eds about it. Other people have flagged it as worry, and defenders have said this is no big deal. But Philip Morris sued Australia and said that they couldn't do it. Essentially, what they called it was expropriation, that you know, they essentially were being stolen from because they were promised these returns, and now they're not going to get them. This is a law designed to reduce smoking, which hurts their corporate profits. And you know what happens? You have the normal bureaucracy, the normal lawmaking and enforcement mechanism in Australia. You know, you have the government, the Department of Health equivalent, and now there's another layer, this TPP layer, essentially run through the UN in this case. That will now really decide what happens with this law. And if Philip Morris wins, you know, they can't enforce the law. They have to pay Philip Morris a bunch of money, and there's no recourse. They can't go lower to, like, the courts or the Department of Health and renegotiate it. So it really – it means that the people who are going to enforce the law are not the people that we normally think of and not the people who we have accountable to democratic processes.
And you describe this as basically there's just another layer of bureaucracy on top of the government bureaucracy, which is this private bureaucracy. And, you know, this is one of the things about the TPP that sort of is fascinating from a political standpoint. For years, we hear people on the right, the far right, the libertarian right, you know, talk about this concern about a one world government. And on some levels, this is what the TPP represents. It's just that it's not a democratic government. It's just a corporate government.
Yeah, and it's a corporate government that is going to be hostile to things that sometimes people on the right are hostile to, like environmental regulations, wage policy, investments, public health regulations. You see it in Canada. Canada has come under a lot of these through NAFTA. NAFTA has a process for investors from other countries to sue, essentially, based on things like, you know, Canada had a buy local solar program, and so it was designed to kind of build up the local economy. Naomi Klein writes about it quite a bit, and this changes everything. And to build up solar energy, and they were sued saying, you know, this buy local thing violates NAFTA. You can't do it. If we can't do these kinds of things, that's a big problem for combating global warming. And, you know, and it's also really about the terms of, like, you know, no, this is going to be about international corporations dealing among themselves. There's an example of one corporation in Canada that essentially just incorporated the United States to sue Canada under these things. So there's a lot of corporate malfeasance going on here. It's not that, you know, these trades are really being opened up. It's that, you know, the terms under who gets to set these rules about, you know, how laws are enforced are now going to be elevated to a whole new bureaucratic level, but one that's not accountable in the ways that we normally think of in democratic structures, which themselves are often not that accountable.
Right, right. And so when we talk about these investor, I'm not sure exactly what they're called again, these arbitrators made up of corporate. My understanding is that they're going to basically be industry. They're going to pick three industry lawyers who's going to determine whether or not, you know, in the examples that you give, Australia has imposed or has in some ways, I guess, stolen profits from tobacco firms because they're actively seeking to cut down on the amount that their citizens are smoking. Give us a couple of the other examples that you just mentioned. But also, I'm curious, you know, one example I've heard is, for instance, let's say the TPP exists and the U.S. government decides we're finally going to mandate that the U.S. government will under Medicaid D use its ability to buy pharmaceuticals in bulk and thereby driving down the price. Is that one of those things where theoretically the pharmaceutical industry could say, okay, we're going to set up a subsidiary in a Pacific Rim country and sue the United States because they're now inhibiting our profits?
Absolutely. Canada is actually already being sued under NAFTA for essentially trying to enforce its drug patent laws. There's going to be a couple mechanisms through which this happens, the TPP and the investor settlements, one of them, but it's part of the whole kind of privatization of law that you're going to see U.S. use its you know, huge footprint and its huge markets to force a lot of our really terrible patent laws into other developing countries. So laws that people in the United States, which is a rich country, right? You know, we can, even people here think these laws are abusive and they're just huge corporate giveaways. They're going to be forced on a lot of developing nations, a lot of nations that aren't necessarily rich in the developing world and in the Pacific Rim. Things like drug patent laws, the plus 75, life plus 75 laws that were basically designed to protect Walt Disney's estate.
Right.
A lot of, you know, the kind of really gross things that we see in our corporate and patent law. And the idea here is to move the enforcement towards whatever regime is most favorable to corporations. And whenever there's a dispute or whenever there's an opportunity to really kind of have to haggle out whether or not something's fair, it takes place in a realm that's just not accountable to the public. It's not transparent and it's not democratic.
So, I mean, give me your sense. I mean, I want to move on to your other piece, but I mean, give me your sense. Like, what is the argument I mean, what is the motivation behind this? Is it just purely is this just purely a function of there's a lot of money out there? I mean, it seems to me that most of the stuff in this, most of the stuff in the TPP, it seems to me, has to do with so-called intellectual property and patents and in pharmaceuticals. I mean, if you were to strip a lot of the implications of all those things out, it seems to me that there wouldn't be that much left to this. What's driving this? Is it just sheer lobbying and corporate money? Is there any other rational argument behind it?
You know, people are trying to figure this out, right? You know, President Obama is a president who likes taking half a loaf of a bread, and so he thinks if he has a deal that could be described as good in any way, he'll try to take it. There's a military angle. They obviously want to, have military primacy in the Pacific Rim and, you know, bind a bunch of nations with them in to keep China in what they see as balance. So there's, you know, a host of probably not all that great military justifications as well. There's also the idea that I think America is the best country in the world and we're going to export our brilliant economic system outward. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, say what you will about America as a whole, but in the past 40 years, we've just really turned our economy over to really predatory, bubble-blowing Wall Street firms towards a real defense of 1% wealth, be it intellectual property or bankruptcy law, and, you know, wage suppression everywhere we see, which is related to the other piece. And I think, you know, that's the fact that the worst parts of that system are the ones that are going to be pushed out forward, the ones that are about intellectual property, about Wall Street, about private rights of actions of corporations, is really telling that that's what we're going to send outward. And that's what's going to reflect the United States. And I think that's a really terrible thing.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm it doesn't even feel like it feels like as much of the impetus is coming from the White House as anything else. Right. I mean, you know, we're in this new era where Obama's not afraid to come out for net neutrality or rationalize our relationship with Cuba or come to a deal with China on emissions, et cetera, et cetera. This one he seems to be holding on to. And, you know, it doesn't have that same sort of dynamic, it seems to me, of like, here's this onslaught coming to at him from, you know, let me put it this way. You don't walk around and get the sense that the average American citizen is just like, when are we going to get this TPP thing done? You know what I mean? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a natural consistency that isn't wearing an 800 to I don't know what an expensive suit costs, because I haven't bought a suit in literally a half a day, I think a decade. But
kind of suit where you don't get one free when you buy it. Probably.
Exactly. Right. Like the kind of suit you can't find at Men's Warehouse those seem to be the only people who are interested in this. And like they're dragging along a bunch of Democrats too.
Yeah, and the way they want to do it too, which is a kind of trust us, we'll handle it, and then, you know, just sign off on what we're going to do, is exactly what Democrats did not do during the budget negotiations when they wanted to strip out parts of Social Security and cut it. And, you know, in 2011, these kind of austerity debates. To the extent it was trusted in a lot of the healthcare debates, that's why we don't have a public option. That's why drug companies got these really sweetheart deals. So, I mean, in terms, you know, it's great that the White House has come out more aggressive on a lot of things, especially things that they can do through the executive branch. This is one place where it's exactly the kind of trust us that we should not be doing.
Right. All right. Well, let's turn to your other piece, because it's not wholly unrelated, it seems to me. Why are liberals resigned to low wages? What do you mean by that? I mean, in terms of there's a certain passivity, I guess, on behalf of some on, I don't know, I would call it the left, but in liberal circles, that tells a story as to why our wages have stagnated so greatly over the past 30 years.
Right. So I think, you know, when a lot of people talk, and it's provocative to liberals, but I think a lot of the kind of chattering class or the kind of people who really dominate the public sphere on concepts of the economy, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, why are wages stagnating? Why is the American worker doing so poorly? And they, you know, they'll quickly talk about, oh, well, it's sociology, it's about families and who's marrying who, or it's about education, or it's about technology and globalizations. But it's essentially about these kind of ethereal forces that no one really controls, or to the extent we control them, we basically blame them on individuals, that they're not trying hard enough, or they're not doing jumping through the right hoops. When really, when we look at it, and this is a real change, I think, in the way economists talk about the economy, is you know, what they've always talked about in the past, but I think recently it's come back, is that it's really about power in the marketplace. It's about full employment. It's about the way corporations are structured. And it's about workers' just general bargaining power and the way the government really sets the laws. And I think without understanding that, we're not going to understand why unemployment is going to continue to go down, but wages won't necessarily budge, or they certainly won't increase very much. People are kind of hoping that this will happen, but it's not going to happen without an actual political problem.
All right. So let's talk, because one of the things that I hear is, and you touch on this, is that it's basically robots and globalization that are taking our jobs. And it obviously, that means we have less jobs for people here. And that means that when you have less jobs, obviously, people are more desperate to work and therefore can't command the proper amount of wages. Why is the robot story not accurate in your view?
And one thing, one reason is we just don't see it in the data, right? There's just not this growth in productivity. We don't actually see workers being substituted out. If anything, the problem's kind of the opposite, that workers are so cheap right now that there's no need to really innovate solutions and requirements for them. I mean, this is kind of one way economic historians thought about the South, especially before the New Deal and the Second Reconstruction, is that, you know, you had slavery or you had indentured servitude or debt peonage. And so, like, you could kind of be a backwards country because you just had labor so immiserated you didn't have to innovate anything. That's a very exaggerated form of it, but it's a real form of it. And, you know, the idea that you would look at the productivity numbers and say, oh, my God, there's so much investment that's replacing workers, or wow, the productivity per workers that are remaining, which is kind of how you'd see this, is skyrocketing, is just not happening.
So in other words, let me just understand from a layperson's perspective. We've heard that how productivity has grown over the past 30 years, but it's grown at a pace and in a sort of trajectory that doesn't indicate big technological breakthroughs that are replacing large swaths of workers.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's nothing that shows that workers have suddenly become a lot more important to the economy than they've always been. I mean, those changes have been happening for 100 years. We can argue whether or not, to what extent it has caused problems for workers over the past 30 years, and there's definitely a case to be made for that. But the idea that, like, right now going forward, we will never see wages increase isn't true. And also for highly educated workers or engineers or computer scientists or the people who we think would benefit from this kind of economy, their wages haven't gone up either. So it seems like a much bigger problem. And one thing I argue it's kind of nihilism, because the way the robot story is told isn't really as much an analytical story often when you hear it. It's almost a kind of palliative, well, at least we don't have to deal with this as a political problem. We don't have to go out. You know, I've heard it from labor people or from other Democrats that were just like, well, yeah, the robots are taking all the jobs and that sucks, but what can we do about it? As opposed to, no, wait, we actually have to organize. And even if the robots are taking all the jobs, well, that means that, you know, the government, you know, workers should own robots or whatever, you know, or like the idea, it's a means to not actually have to think of this as a political problem that's done through the state that we need to organize on and demand higher wages and more prosperity.
Why do you think there's that tendency? I mean, I guess I come up with a couple of stories as to why the labor leadership would say that, is that they just don't want to have to argue on that terrain, and rather just sort of stay in their silo and get their remaining workers as much of a deal as they could get. And I certainly understand, you know, why centrist prognosticators and analysts would make that argument, because that also is just sort of like, it's nature. You can't stop the rain. You can't stop the fact that technology is going to displace us, and that it makes it easier for us to hire somebody in Bangladesh. And so, of course, our wages would go down.
Absolutely. The nature is the right metaphor, right? Because the way a lot of this free market economics has infiltrated a lot of the ways people think now is that it treats the economy as this kind of natural thing. And crucially that, you know, the only thing that really matters, like the only thing that matters for the rain is the clouds and a few other things. The only thing that matters for wages is your human capital and some technology. And that's it. There's not much, there's nothing you can really change. When really we know that, you know, things like minimum wage, things like labor unions, things like full employment, things like CEO pay all really affect who benefits from the prosperity that, how productivity goes up, what happens to wages. You know, it's so funny when I hear a lot of people say, oh, what we need is more productivity. We need, you know, better educated people. We need harder working people. We know from the last 30 years that won't budge wages because wages and productivity have completely separated. You know, we're more productive. We're richer. The economy has doubled in its actual wealth per person over the past 35 years. But wages are basically flat, or maybe they're up like 5 or 10% when the economy's up 100%.
So in other words, I mean, and just to be really clear here, what we have is a distribution problem. Wages have been going up just to only for a very narrow subset of people who work in the economy in some fashion.
Yes, essentially the people who sit on top of the economy, CEOs, executives, the financial sector, people who hold certain kinds of property, land, especially in very desirable cities. Those are places where we don't really think of like, oh, wow, that CEO worked 400 times harder. That's why his income's up 400 times more. Or, you know, those people who packaged all those mortgages that they knew were going to explode have been so productive they need to have these huge paychecks. There we have to actually look at the structure of the economy, what kind of regulations are in place, what kind of taxes are in place. And we know that that distributes the income just as much as anything else related to, you know, how hard people work or the technology that they have.
I know we skipped the Federal Reserve, but I want to just stay on this. I mean, because the story that we're told as young children is the harder you work, the more money you make, the more value you have to society, the more money you make. You know, you wouldn't pay these baseball players millions of dollars a year unless people want to show up and watch them. That's their value. But the structure of our economy has been rigged or structured in such a way now that those sort of like aphorisms, I guess, or principles are just simply not followed. I mean, you talk about this in terms of how our productive enterprises are organized, and that's that idea that, you know, CEOs and board of directors and shareholders are, and then of course, you know, we talk sort of about the broader financialization of our economy, are reaping all the rewards of the increased productivity of workers. So in other words, the same amount of remuneration is going out. In fact, it's grown because our economy has grown. It's just that it's just getting siphoned off. And on this program, we've had Bill Lozonik on from UMass, who's talked about a lot of those reasons why he thinks including stock buybacks and all of those things have been incentivized by our tax code over the years. But let's talk about the Federal Reserve. How is that one of the culprits?
Unemployment has been very high for the past 7 years. And then in general, unemployment has been much higher over the past 30 or 40 years than it was during the mid-century period. When labor markets are slack, there's just not as much demand for work. For workers, and workers have less bargaining power to demand higher wages. They're less credible if they're going to leave to take another job, which might give them a raise. When unemployment's above 6% for 6 years, or however you want to break it down, since the Great Recession started, there's a lot of slack that's built in the economy, and it's allowed executives and shareholders to claim much more of the surplus that's generated in the workplace. It's brought the returns of capital very high. So it's not even that, you know, workers get a smaller slice. It's that there's a smaller pie for workers, period, because, you know, capital holders or shareholders, as Bill Lozonik argues persuasively, have much more power than they did 35 years ago, and now in the Great Recession have even more. And I think, you know, it's important to understand that it's really, you know, watching the Federal Reserve eventually the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. They think maybe this year, hopefully not. But the moment they do, it's kind of starting to signal, well, this is as low as unemployment will go. And I think people are hoping that something magic will happen when unemployment gets to below a certain point. And hopefully wages will start to increase. But it's important to understand workers still work in these corporate structures that are regulated by laws that shove a lot of wealth upward. And, you know, you can't just, you know, let unemployment go to 10% and let it hover above at very high rates for half a decade and then hope like 1 month of 5% employment is going to fix everything, right? You know, you need to have unemployment very low to try to balance this out. But the moment it starts to get low, everyone's going to say, well, we're done there. And I think this, like, whether or not there will be like a catch-up period to make up for the Great Recession will be one of the big political struggles in the next decade.
Am I naive to think that really what you should focus on from the Federal Reserve's perspective in terms of when to raise rates should be some type of wage inflation? I mean, some semblance of wage inflation as opposed to simply you get to some magic number that you've made up essentially about unemployment?
Exactly. You want to look at wage inflation and overall inflation because, you know, what might be wage inflation might just be that workers' wages are catching up to what they should have been as a result if the Great Recession didn't happen or wasn't as severe as it was. But yeah, you know, what the Fed's going to do is going to say, well, if unemployment gets very low, we believe these kind of convoluted stories about how that will then cause inflation to skyrocket. And we want to be ahead of the curve. And from everyone's point of view is that these theories are not well developed. It's not clear what they are. Unemployment was 4% under Bill Clinton. It was one of the few times we've actually had broad-based wage gains in a while. And there was no inflation threat. Like, the economy didn't fall apart or overheat so much it exploded, which is what their worry is. So I think, you know, it's not just a matter of like, oh, well, they got unemployment to this low number, we're done. It's about, well, how low can it go and how long can we keep it there and what are the trade-offs? Because there's a lot of, you know, workers have just have these scars from the Great Recession. It's how much are we going to let them actually try to heal versus, oh, okay, we've finally done enough. Let's now call this the new normal and proceed from here.
And then your third element you mentioned is government policy, which on some level we've covered, but it deals with issues like wage decline. It deals with issues about unionization and things like you mentioned, bankruptcy laws, and I would imagine also sort of lack of free higher education. I mean, all no child care, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, one thing I'd really want to emphasize is taxes. I mean, you know, there was a really, for people who paid attention to the so-called fiscal cliff and what was going to happen with the Bush tax cuts, you know, there's a lot of fight about income taxes and, you know, who's rich? Should they go up for 400,000 or people make 400,000, people make a million? Where should they kind of like kick in? But there's very little talk about the estate tax or the capital tax on dividends or capital income, people with essentially shareholders, which are all predominantly 1% and even the tip top of 1%. Phenomena. Like, that's the people who make that income. And, you know, they went up a little bit, but they didn't go up to the Clinton years. And, you know, those are really.
Or the Reagan years, for that matter.
Certainly not the Reagan years, where they were roughly equal to where we think they should be. And, you know, those matter a lot for decisions because, as Lozanik shows, and we have a paper at Roosevelt from Josh Mason. There's other evidence. There's very good evidence on this that when dividend taxes go down, money leaves the firm quicker. But there's no real evidence that it like boosts wages or boosts investment, which is what everyone said it would. And that's a real important way for how who benefits from what happens in corporations.
That to me seems like one of the fundamental things is basically just this idea of, you know, what we consider capital gains. Right. I mean, on some level, it's fairly arbitrary. I'm not even clear. I mean, other than the fact that it's not something that you labor for, it's pretty wide open. Right. I mean, it's not like you're actually investing in a company that is going to allow the company to grow and create jobs. It's you just, you know, any more than I'm investing on the Patriots to win the Super Bowl.
Right, right. In some sense, it's really what's left over after you've paid the workers and you've kept the machines running. That's the capital gains. And so it is this kind of residual profit that's left over. And, you know, if it's taxed less, there's more incentive to create more of it, which means you should lower wages or, you know, invest less or innovate less.
Right. And there's nothing to say that, like, you're going to create more of this. You're going to pace yourself and create more of it 10 years out or 15 years out or 20 years out, which is the way that these companies used to function. Right. It's like, hey, I can get a lot of it if I just cut my labor force for 3 or 5 years and I'm on to my next thing.
Absolutely. And the flip side is even more important is if the CEO can't tell the investors who always want money out of the firm to say, hey, you need to hold on for a year or two because we're going to try to innovate this cool thing and it may not work. But if it does, it'll be great for society. If shareholders have essentially a veto and CEOs can't say that, which is what you want businesses to be able to say, that's a major problem. Or if shareholders essentially make the terms of those kinds of gambles for companies with the innovation we want so punitive that it's very difficult to do, that just means we're going to have less brilliant things or things that make life better.
Indeed. Mike Konzel, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link to both pieces at majority.fm.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. Boop, boop. My son, Saul, has already, like, he's, that noise he knows because we Skype, obviously, with his grandparents. And also the one where, it doesn't seem to be on this, but it seems to be on my phone where it goes boop, bow, pick, pick, boop, bow, pick, and he loves that sound. What's that? I'm always, we're always prank phone calling my Konzel, because Saul also loves to hear about things like monetary policy, and he's a very, you know, strange 2-year-old boy. His favorite song is actually Happy Birthday, which he apparently, since we sang it to him a month ago, he's not stopped singing it. That's the only song he sings. He sings it to everybody. And he's not very good at it. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun part of the show. I mean, I don't, look, I'm not, it's not like I say it to his face. You guys are sitting there like shaking your head back and forth like it's not appropriate. You got to press the button on your thing, buddy. You went back. Oh, I put you back on the button.
You bastard.
You're lucky. I almost put the button over here.
The button was off because yesterday for Ring of Fire, you debuttoned me.
That's right. You were debuttoned.
And then I was rebuttoned this morning.
No, I don't say it to his face. You're a bad singer. I say it behind his back, though.
Well, clearly.
Yeah, I don't mind that. All right.
This is really inappropriate.
Folks, just a reminder, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to majority.fm. You can also support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. That's one of those things where it's just like a win-win-win situation. That is like so obvious, it's almost grotesque.
I don't know why that's funny.
It is like the Bob Durst version of I don't know what. I'm sorry, I got jinxed on my mind. I watched that show. It's creepy.
When did you finish it?
Just the other day.
Me too.
And we'll talk more about that.
Yeah, we got to have a little jinx conversation.
Yes, I think so. But also, Just Coffee, it's great coffee. You can get the Majority Report blend. You'll enjoy it. And, of course, if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you haven't gone over to the Indiegogo campaign, checked out our perks, check it out at themajorityreport.com. We're planning on putting up some, I think, some new perks by the end of the week. And so here's just a little, I think I mentioned something from a listener, Don Quixote, will go up. And also, I think I mentioned the other day, too, about the Marin v. Cedar stuff for longtime listeners. So Mark Maron was on Chris Hayes last night. And in the, after the break, I will tell you what I texted to Marin and what his response was.
By the way.
Did you congratulate him on a great appearance?
I'm not going to tell you until after the break. That's called a tease.
And I saw something.
Well,
that
I'm teasing along with you. Because clearly you did not congratulate him for a great appearance.
No, that's not necessarily true at all.
See, there you go. Teased again.
Just go to the fun half.
All right. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com. You can listen to the show live, You can stream past podcasts. You can download podcasts. There's a difference, folks. Download them. They live on your phone. You can go into the subway. You can listen to them. Or you can go into the, I don't know, tunnel. Or if you're out in the hinterlands.
While you run.
Well, when you run, you could stream it if you get good cell service.
Yeah, but it's easier if you download it. It doesn't jump in and out. It's...
Not necessarily.
Well,
you've never listened to the app anyways. As a member, you can have a searchable database of all the past shows. And, of course, you can one-touch IM me and one-touch call me during this part of the show. We'll be right back.